Welcome to the Ultimate Farm Wife podcast. On this channel, we're going to be discussing all things marrying a farmer, moving to the land, and becoming integrated with a family farming operation. Whether you're moving to the farm for the first time, or whether you're moving back into a family farming operation, we discuss the ins and the outs of all of it. So let's jump into today's episode. Welcome to season 7 of So You've Married a Farmer, Now What? Really looking forward to jumping into this season with everybody. Not only will we be addressing the same questions and themes that we have been along our journey, not only will we be covering the usual topics that you've come to expect from this podcast and YouTube channel, but we will also be deep diving into value adding on a family farming operation. What is it that you need to know to be able to find your place on farm? Is this something that you can use to fit into the family farming mold or use it as an additional asset and income for the future? As this season progresses, you will be addressed with lots of different methods and different family farming setups and how they have been able to value add. So let's jump in to the first episode. Hi, I'm Katja Williams, the Ultimate Farm Wife, and today we are talking with Fiona. Welcome, Fiona. Can you please introduce yourself, your family, and your farm?
Hi, Katja. Thank you so much for having me today. So I am a farmer. I'm a fifth generation family farmer on a property in central New South Wales. We are a multi-generational property, but probably different to a lot of people in that each of us own different components. We've got different land holdings, so we have some financial separation within that. We all work together, but everyone's got their own little piece of the pie as well. Our farm's been operating since 1886, and it includes cereal cropping, merino sheep, second cross lamb production, and then in addition to that traditional farming, we've got a value add component to our prime lamb operation, which is called Outback Lamb. And at the moment, we're specialising in producing and selling premium farm fresh lamb sausage rolls. I'm married to Bill, and we've been married since 2003. I didn't travel too far for my husband. He was from Trundle, just up the road. And we have four children that are now 14, 13 and 12.
Beautiful gap, and sounds like a wealth of knowledge you will be bringing to the podcast today, Fiona. So let's start with your introduction back on farm. So fifth generation farmer, how did you decide, or when did you decide, yes, you wanted to be a farmer, yes, you wanted to come back to the family farm, and then how did that look for you in that transition?
So I'm 53. I was born in 1971, but I grew up with there's four siblings in my family, one brother and three sisters. And I think it was pretty traditional in that we always thought that my brother would come back to the farm. We were all lucky enough to be provided a great education. I was always interested in agriculture and worked, I liked outdoor. I was more outdoorsy than I was indoorsy. And I always thought that I probably would work in agriculture. Straight out of school, I started a systems ag degree at Hawkesbury. And I did 12 months of that and then moved to Orange Ag College and did a Bachelor of Business in Ag Commerce there. And it was, so I always knew I'd work in ag. My brother was at home and when he finished Ag College, and he did a few years, but it just really, the timing wasn't great. There was, I guess, conflict, like in the nicest possible way, like between him and Dad, over like ideas and Dad's expectations and that sort of thing. And it was just really hard. My brother wanted a bit of a breakaway and Dad needed a hand. My other sister was doing ag up at Gatton, and we kind of went, I was sort of between jobs and said, well, how about I come home and just talk to Dad over a period of a week or two about what that might look like, in terms of I was in my mid-20s and I didn't really you know, we always wanted Sim to have the option to come back to the farm because that was always the plan. And I wasn't really looking to take over per se. I didn't know what my future was. And I was lucky I had an, or we called her auntie, Mary, next door, who she'd been a farmer in her own right. So we sort of had, I had people around me that were farming and as women, and it never, I just sort of thought, well, I don't really know what I want to do, but it's not that foreign for me. So when we were organising it with Dad and Mum at the time, it was very much, well, let's just pay me a wage, because he was worried that I'd, you know, it was just a fill-in for a couple of years and I'd get sick of it, or it'd be too hard physically and that type of stuff, that maybe it wasn't going to be for me. So it's like, well, just pay me a wage and then there'll be no sort of obligation. Whereas for Sim, it was a lot harder because he had that, there was an expectation that he would take over eventually. He wasn't really paid. He was doing share farming and a lot of their profits were going back into the farm, and it probably just wasn't really well thought out. Dad thought he was doing the right thing, but it probably wasn't meeting everybody's needs at the time for them. And I think, and I can probably say this, like, in the nicest possible way, that I don't think they broke the mold when they made Dad. Like, he's of a particular generation, and they like to do things a certain way, and they've often never worked for other people, and they're bossy, and modern workers like to do things a little differently, and the industry is evolving, and there, you know, there could have been some give and take, I think, that would have benefited everybody. But at the end of the day, when you own the title of the land, it's yours to do with what you want. And that was why Dad and Sim went their separate ways. Whereas mine came in more short term, and then we went more long term as time went on. And I liked it. So ended up buying a little soldier settlers block, 1,500 acres next door to the family farm. And it was back in the day where interest rates were quite low and you could talk yourself into, with a good business plan and that type of stuff, you could talk yourself into the full amount and working capital and all that sort of stuff, because I didn't have anything. And so that was how we started. And then Bill, when we got married, he had his own block up at Trundle. And so we just kind of had enough to keep going, I guess, is how that worked out. My sister came back from ag college and she was working for Dad then. I started having children, so stepped away. And the maternity benefits were zero. So I hadn't thought of everything, but we were working for ourselves at that stage. And look, just kind of making it up as we went along. We didn't know how big our family would be, what our plans were. We had some trouble having children, so I did IVF as well, although it clearly worked because we ended up with four. Although my last one was not IVF, he was a little surprise.
Beautiful little surprise. So when you started growing your family and, you know, a lot of us on the land, especially if we are, you know, working the farm alongside our husbands or our families, we don't have paid maternity leave. So was there any tips, tricks or advice you would give to anyone who is moving into that stage of their life to either pre-think about, or something that helped you along the way? Like, I know many of us have periods of time that we don't remember when we've got young kids and we're just trying to put one foot in front of the other. We go into survival mode. But was there anything that you sort of remember and stand out in that area?
I think that out here, like, we're in central New South Wales, so it's a dry land environment. So working within the environment that we do, I would say the traditional model out here is to have some form of off-farm income. So Bill and I would be the exception rather than the rule. But also in saying that, we did have a lot of my peers, when they were starting their families, they were still working under the umbrella of a family organisation. So there was some buffers with that. Whereas Bill and I were financially separate and off on our own, so we could make that work financially, I think, is the big thing. And because I'd always worked in ag, like, I don't have a lot of superannuation. I don't have, but we thought about it and looked at our options, and at the time, and I think I'll let you know in 10 to 15 years how this plan worked out, but at the time, as I said, interest rates were low. We decided to kind of invest in ourselves. So we were buying little blocks as they came up, building our assets and paying down debt and trying to do that kind of thing rather than investing in things off farm. And that has come to bite us in certain ways, like in the drought, for example. It means we are 100% reliant on farm income. And that really ties you down when you're working in extreme weather events. So like drought and flood, which is what we had. We had a real run of that. And it's had a massive impact on our finances. And there's been times where, you know, I'm thinking, oh, my God, I'm going to have to go and get a job. Like, it's not all beer and Skittles, as they say. But it was, there's also a wonderful freedom of being financially independent from a an operation, like a big family operation, and not just reliant on a tiny wage. It gave us more choices in other.
And I'd like to deep dive into that a little bit more, Fiona, because I think that's so interesting. And I know that a lot of the community are interested in that separation, like still working with the farm, but also having their own sort of operation and their own financial independence. What mindset did you find you had to sort of shift into to be able to say, okay, yes, we're going to purchase another property, and how are we going to make that work in? Because I think for a lot of people, when I'm talking to them, particularly the younger generation, they just think, oh my gosh, where would I even start in acquiring land? What do I need to do? What's the mindset? Like, to them, it's all just too much. So what are the bite-sized pieces that we can jump into that to make it a little bit easier, break it down a bit more?
I think, like, we bought our first block in 2003, and it was a different generation then, like, so a different era. So I think that really, it's probably those opportunities aren't as open now as they were, and the land values have increased so much. It felt massive at the time. I look back now and just wish I'd bought 10 times as much, do you know what I mean? And really leveraged everything and gone right into it. But it was an era where the smaller, like 1,500-acre farms were not viable anymore, really, for people who were relying on farming solely as an income. And it was a time where people were getting, we had to scale to be viable. So the opportunities arose around us, I guess. And it was us looking at when we were talking ourselves into it, and because it is hard to take on massive amounts of debt, it really is. And we were trying to have a really global perspective and looking at the values of agricultural land across the world and what that means. And I'm sure everybody has the same thing. You know, as a neighbour's place sells for a record high, you're like, they'll never make a living off that. You know, like, it's ridiculous. Imagine it being worth that. How can they borrow the money? Blah, blah, blah. And it was the same even when we were doing it. So it's much, much harder now, but at the time we definitely were trying to have a really, we had a hard plan of where we wanted to be, the amount of country that we needed to own, and to do that alongside our parents. So we weren't, you know, Dad's the kind of farmer, like, he was never going to hand off his farm when his kids were in their 30s. And ready to take it to the next level. So we had to do that ourselves. Like, our succession, it might even miss my generation. Do you know what I mean? It may go straight to my kids, because we're in our 50s now and already thinking about that next step of, because as farmers, you do have to work, you know, 10 or 15 years out and really think about what that's going to look like and where you want to be and what you want to do and how you're going to accommodate the variables and the changing sort of wishes of people within your farm. And I think there's so much about succession out there now. And again, I think succession has changed fundamentally from when, like, I was a young farmer in my mid-20s to now. I don't think you can be equal. I think that more consideration has to be given to the siblings that have grown that farm and develop that business over a period of 20 or 30 years and the value that comes with that, how much that business has increased and how much that increase in value is down to their hard work. But I do also think that if you're paying out people who are off farm, that there's a really important need to recognise that if they have to wait till their parents, and it's normally girls, but we're the exception there again, if people have to wait for their parents to die for them to realise a substantial asset, they don't have that opportunity to grow it. Then they get something and they can only really spend it, because by the time they inherit it, they're, you know, in their 50s or 60s, and there's not a lot they can do with it. Whereas usually the boys who inherit the farm will get it young enough to be able to grow that business. So there's a real discrepancy there that often comes down to sexes, where, and it's where the problems start, I believe, because the people that are off farm, again, usually the sisters, are like, he's got a farm worth X million and I got the house in town, which is worth 500,000. And they're two very different values. But again, communication is key, respecting the needs of everyone, but really understanding that if you have not been involved in that business and haven't grown it, you don't have a right to it, I don't think, because otherwise the debt continues forever and ever and ever. And we're not always going to have debt interest rates below 7%. It's not a sustainable model for people to have to borrow the value of the farm every generation to pay out siblings.
Yeah, absolutely. And Fiona, you were saying, you know, in your current setup, you know, it most likely looks like succession will skip a generation. How do you and Bill feel about that? And how have you set that up for the potential future with your kids? Have you spoken to your kids about that already? Like, they are in their teenage years. So how does that look for you and your, like, your family, your children?
Well, we do. We talk about that kind of thing, you know, not every week, but from time to time. I don't know. Like, my dad's in his 80s now, and he's really stepped away from the farm. And we, like, 15 years ago with him, we did a lot of succession planning and all that kind of stuff. So there was always talk about what that might look like and that type of thing. I think when you're planning, you know, when I was making plans in my mid-30s, again, if I'm being perfectly honest, I would have thought that Dad might have retired by now. Like, I didn't think that he'd be in his mid-80s still farming. But in saying that, you know, when you own the title, like, you get all the say. And if I didn't like it, I could lump it. Do you know what I mean? So that's what, for us, in our personal situation, having that financial independence, farming and doing what we want, and albeit carrying a lot of debt, because I think, again, this is the difference when you're working across many generations, is that the younger generation often have a much higher appetite for risk and borrowing and that type of thing. And that's certainly, you know, been represented in our family by Bill and I. As Dad's exiting the business, like, we've really focused on his debt reducing so that he can retire comfortably. And as we transition, you know, into more country and stuff like that, which, you know, will happen within the next 3 to 5 years or something. So I wouldn't say it will skip us, but we won't have that opportunity to grow that business more in a way that if we'd inherited it in our 30s is probably the key thing. So that's probably what is different for us. But it's not, you know, like, we're really happy. Do you know what I mean? Like, I like what we do, and we're focused on, like everyone, custodians of the land, looking to be really sustainable, wanting to have a hugely viable business in a changing climate and in a changing economic climate, but also, like, the world appetite for carbon and the what that means to farmers and how we conduct our business in that changing environment is very different to how Dad, you know, was farming. And it's kind of, part of it is exciting and part of it is terrifying. Do you know what I mean? I often say with Dad, like, when he first started farming, half the problem was sourcing information, whereas for us, our problem was filtering information. We had access to so much. So they're very different skill sets to utilise to build your business and to grow. And I don't really know what skill set the next generation needs, but I assume it will be around problem solving and they'll be more entrepreneurial and looking, because, you know, policy and that is developing around us. And it's really going to be key for them to staying abreast of, you know, what's coming.
Yeah, absolutely. So, Fiona, we've talked about moving back to the land, how you became financially independent but still working under the family umbrella and working in with everybody. We've spoken about succession planning. So let's now dive into value adding. So you value added to your prime lamb production business with Outback Lamb. So tell us a little bit about how you value added, why you went in the direction that you did, and how it's all going.
Well, again, it was one of those conversations that really started around the dining room table when your bill had just come through a really exceptionally successful family intergenerational transfer, where the boys had known all their life, you know, who was getting what block, and it was just a matter of, you know, with some complexities obviously thrown into it. But essentially his dad just decided one day, okay, I'm ready to retire. And they just put everything into play that was there. So that worked really, really well. But again, they split their farm into three. So what had been a really viable operation suddenly came under pressure in terms of they either needed more country or different things. And when we were talking about it, I was like, this is held up as this amazing example, but what will happen to the next generation? Do you split that farm then into three again? And are we going to end up like some sort of inverse Irish potato famine where the farms are just getting smaller and smaller and we're trying to be more and more productive? And what kind of pressure does that put on the environment that we live in, particularly when you're in a 500 mil rainfall area? And, you know, just not really seeing it as a model that could be replicated for the next generation. So the natural progression then, like in terms of looking at intergenerational stuff, was, okay, as I said, we'd been buying country, so we had more acres and stuff like that. We were kind of at our limit. We were loving, you know, the farming life and everything, but we were busier than we'd ever been in our life. And, you know, everyone likes to wax lyrical about the country way of life and all that, but we just found we were getting busier and busier and busier. And it wasn't quite as much fun as it used to be. So we were like, okay, what can we do? Let's get busier and start another business. So rather than grow horizontally again for the next generation and try and get more acres so we could then split it into four and keep it viable, we're like, well, let's look at building some value into what we're doing and trying to build in some drought resilience. And just looking at, and I was wanting to connect people more to farming, because I was a bit sick at the time of the bad rap farmers were getting as being seen as these kind of environmental vandals who were part of the problem, when I felt we were just doing an amazing job as being part of the solution. And so I really wanted to share with people outside of farming and agriculture what farm life really is and how we value the environment, how we value animal welfare, how we value all of that kind of stuff. So Outback Lamb was born, and we began very quickly very early on in the piece. We began as doing boxed lamb being processed at a micro abattoir at Canoundra to orders that I sold online, and we moved very quickly then to wholesale into butcher shops. And all the time that I was doing this, we were doing courses and getting involved in programs. So I did a program in Dubbo called Regional Platters, which was basically like a Shark Tank type pitch where we collaborated with other producers and did a pitch, and we ended up winning quite a substantial amount of money, and our pitch was to buy a refrigerated truck to take everyone's produce to Sydney. So we were like growing and being entrepreneurial and innovative, and it was quite a giddy, exciting time doing new things. And we were very able to pivot into new businesses. And then I did another course, and we do try, part of our attitude to learning is, you know, obviously it's lifelong, but we try to do one course a year at some point. And I did another one called Farmers to Founders. And that's when we really looked at, okay, we might move away from boxed meat and wholesale meat to doing a value add like the lamb sausage rolls.
Yep. That all sounds absolutely incredible. And I really appreciate that, you know, you've mentioned that you have taken not only the time but the finances to value add to yourselves and to your business. What a great strategy, because when I talk to a lot of the community, I know that a lot of us are very hesitant in investing in ourselves, in investing in the learning to be able to either do the value adding or get some financial independence from the farm. So that is all really fantastic to hear. I love that you've mentioned, you know, some of the courses that you have done throughout your journey. Is there a course that really stands out, or a peer that really stands out who has given you the confidence in yourself and your business to keep going? Or do you find that confidence built quite naturally with you with the empowerment of the knowledge that you were getting?
I think, you know, when you're learning, when you've got a curious mind and you're in an isolated situation, you really are a sponge. So I listened to a lot of podcasts. I did a lot of what I was doing earlier. Like, I didn't know how to start, I think, is the key thing. And I talked to a few friends, and I, like, chatted to strangers on planes, and like I was so annoying, I think, and just was like, I'm thinking about doing this thing, what do you reckon, blah blah blah, and you know, I really want to share the story, and just gathering like a sponge people's ideas and what they responded to and all that sort of thing, because there is a period like of the birth of an idea that you can't just cookie cutter it off somebody else, or you know, do A, B, C, and D. Like, I was literally coming up with this from scratch. So I think that it's really important to know what you're good at and what you're capable of and where you should outsource that kind of thing. So I spoke to a lot of friends, and I'd done a business degree. I had friends in marketing and stuff like that, and I was like, I want to do this, but like, why would I spend $10,000 or $15,000 on a schmick web page? Like, we're never going to make that kind, like, it's going to take me years to make that return even before I pay that back. And they were like, just start, use Wix, like do a monthly subscription. And if it doesn't work in a year, then you can just close it down and that kind of thing. And it's, you know, use a template. It's really simple, blah, blah, blah. And now you don't even need to do that. Like, you can tell ChatGPT to do a web page for you and it will. Like, it's so, AI is amazing. So that was sort of the first step for me, and also being brave enough to tell people like what your idea is and doing something a bit different was another step. I look back now and don't know why I was so nervous, but at the time you're a bit, if you don't want to be a tool, like, and I just felt a bit funny, but anyway, like, you get over yourself and that kind of thing. And the other thing is, suddenly people, like, the feedback is amazing. Like, people are so kind.
If you're enjoying listening along with us today and learning some tips, tricks, and advice, then please like, subscribe, and even share this interview with someone who you think would need to hear this information or who might benefit from other interviews done right here on this channel. Now let's get back in today's episode.
And it just, they pump air in your tires. Like, they really talk you up. You know, get nominated for awards or different things. You get recognized. People respond. If you're doing the right thing, that's a good fit for you. And we really focus on being authentic. And so I just felt really valued in, because we were sharing our story. I felt incredibly valued in what we were doing, and it just kind of, yeah, it did pump air in my tires, and we just went from, you know, happy to do the next thing and the next thing. And also then that entrepreneurial mindset is quite addictive as well. Do you know what I mean? You want to, you're comfortable being uncomfortable, and you want to do more things and try different stuff, and it's quite thrilling. Do you know what I mean?
Yes, I do. It definitely is addictive, and particularly when you get one project off the ground, you think, oh, I can do this again, or I can replicate this, or I can do something else and learn, another skill in another area. So absolutely understand that. So with everything that is going on, Fiona, how did you and Bill balance having a family, value adding, having the farms, still having the involvement in the family farm? How did everything fit in? How did you do everything? How are you still doing everything?
I think I talked about this with a girlfriend only this morning, and it was, I think it's really important to remember that you sometimes just treading water and keeping your head above water is enough.
Yeah.
And I can't say that clearly enough. Like, you don't, sometimes you do just need to stop and gather your thoughts and have a deep breath, because it can get crazy. Like, and when you're tired, when particularly like you've got young kids, when, you don't think well when you're tired. It's so I kind of, try to be in tune, and like I write a lot of lists. I do stuff that fills my bucket. I learn to say no a lot of the time as well. I try to work on different pillars of growing the business. So for us, it's about community and, it's about health and food provenance. But when people ask me to do something, I think to myself, okay, what's this ticking off? I also, as I got older, I'm a lot more comfortable saying to people, look, I'd love to do that, but I'm actually going to have to, I have a fee and I'm really sorry, but it's a little bit of self-love and a self-respect to be valued. And people honestly don't mind at all. Like, they often don't even think of it, because we're used to an environment where people are generous with their time and their skills and their expertise, and they're happy to share. But I think that you can't keep giving and giving and giving without putting a little bit of value on that. And again, that sort of fills your own bucket and gives you a sense of self-worth, but it also takes away, the tire kickers. So you're not, your time's not always, you don't waste your time as much either.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. No, I agree with that, especially when I get asked to do keynote talks or anything like that, even if it's just a smaller event. You've got to think about childcare. You've got to think about, well, if I'm not on farm, that means someone else has to take up my jobs, or I have to employ someone to take out of my job. So then I've got paying for childcare, I'm paying for someone to take on my role, and then I've got travel and accommodation. And so definitely when you're adding that package together, it's like, yes, please. Like, I may not be making something, but I'm not losing, the dollars and the time to be able to put into something else. I think it's definitely important that you said you learn to say no. That is a skill set within itself. I'm another list writer. I love list writing, and I love that you've got your businesses broken down to pillars. What am I contributing to? Because definitely ticking off, something at the end of the day that really aligns with either your personal values or your business values definitely helps. Like, it's not as if you're just doing the same task over and over again. You're doing something that will build for the future as well. So I absolutely love that insight, Fiona. Thank you so much for that. For someone who is moving to the farm for the first time or back into a family business, do you have any advice, tips, tricks, anything for them to fit, help fit within that space?
I think the importance of building a strong community around you, even when you're moving to a really remote place, you've got neighbours, you've got people in town, you've got to give in some level in order to receive. So I think if you're new to town, and you'll know very quickly if you're not cut out for it. Do you know what I mean? Some people just aren't. They can't handle the remoteness or that type of thing. So that's okay too. Like, it's but to tap into the great wealth of being in a rural and remote community, you have to invest in that community at some level, whether it be in a committee or your time or just working bees or something. And you don't have to be in everything, like pick things that really fill your bucket and maybe do two or three things. But so we're like tied up with picnic racing. Obviously, when the kids were little, we did like preschool and all that kind of stuff. I do less now within the community because I've got kids out of the community and we're contributing to, like, they're away at boarding school, so we're busy contributing to their communities and creating value for them by trying to, you know, set good examples, for want of a better word. But it's because everything is what you put into it, but it comes back, you know, many times in abundance. So that's how we kind of approach it. But sometimes you're just tired, like you can't do everything. So just building strong relationships with your neighbours and the broader farming community and being really respectful. So we're seeing a lot of differences now in terms of, you know, whether you've got merinos or Dorpers, whether you're regenerative or traditional farming, all that kind of thing. It's a big, big planet. We're a big country. There's room for everybody, room for lots of different ideas. Nobody's got it right. Like, we're all working in really unique environments and trying to adapt to that unique geography that we are located in with our farms. So there's no right or wrong. And people do tend to get a bit sanctimonious. They think that there's the chosen way. They become quite zealous in their beliefs. And I think if you step away from that and try to be a lot more respectful of people's personal choices, it's a big step in the right direction.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you, Fiona, so much for coming on the podcast today. We have covered so much that I know will be of use to the community here at the Ultimate Farm Wife, whether we are talking coming back into a family farm, succession planning, value adding. We've really appreciated your time, your journey, and what you have shared with us today. So thank you so much.
Thank you again for having me. I've really loved it.
EnviroBug has sent the Ultimate Farm Wife some of their products to test out and give feedback to you, our community, on what their products are like. EnviroBug is a family-run Australian business founded back in 2008. They provide effective solutions to tough Australian pests without hurting the environment. Based in Victoria, their products are absolutely safe to humans and pets. Here at the Ultimate Farm Wife, with my children and this farm, we have been trialing out their mosquito stops. The mosquito stop stickers are all natural ingredients, including citronella, lavender, and peppermint oils. It is skin-free application, has natural scents, no toxins, and can last up to 72 hours. Perfect for those who are outside on the farm like we are all the time. The mosquito repellent patches really were great for the kids and the adults on farm at keeping mosquitoes at bay. Try them now by clicking the link in the description below and get yourself some EnviroBug mosquito repelling patches. And while you're on their website, have a look at the other products that they can provide you and your family.